Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of And Then There's That, a bi-weekly podcast of people, politics, and punditry in Howard County on the HOCO Mojo Network. I'm Paul Scalney, and I'm here at the Mall in Columbia with my co-host, Dennis Lane. Joining us today is Richie Rule, the president of the Howard County Professional Firefighters Association, the 2000th local of the International Association of Firefighters. You impressed?
I'm impressed. And only my friends call me Richie Rule.
Yeah, so the Richie was good. I like that. All
right. That's a privilege.
Richie and I went to high school together. I can do that. But as always, we first like to take a look at some of the news making the headlines this week. Dennis, what do you have to get us started on this spring break, Earth Day, pre-Easter?
It is Earth Day, April 22nd. Happy Earth Day. Happy Earth Day to our guest. And to
thank you.
Oh,
thank you.
Have you hugged the Earth today?
Wow. Where to go with that?
I just plugged in the extension cord and hit him in my belly. Does that count?
Well, you know, I thought
I did fill up my tank, my gas tank, with super unleaded.
Oh, it's okay. Well, then there's that. I think I'll start off with, I was in Elkridge last night. I attended the Greater Elkridge Community Association's meeting to actually present their case against locating the proposed intermodal terminal in Hanover, Maryland.
Which we've been talking about on the last couple of shows.
We have.
Now, did you have to wear a disguise to actually set foot in Elkridge?
Well, as I said before, I kind of felt like a fart in church, you know? I mean, I was, I didn't really know anybody. I did know people there, but I really kind of played it down key, sat in the back. But as fate would have it, I sat about two seats away from school board member Alan Dyer, who
BFF.
Well, another bizarre twist of fate, I had posted something about Alan on my blog yesterday, and as I was sitting there, like two seats away from him, my phone is lighting up with comments to the blog post. I was like,
Alan, check this out.
You should see what they're saying about you now. Anyway, it was an interesting meeting. The folks in Elkridge turned out in large numbers. I think they were probably close to 200 people there. And presenting their case, and the politicos were there too as well. Senator Ed Casemeyer, delegates Jimmy Malone and Stephen DuBois, and Courtney Watson, who has been on our show, and all of them have said, you know, of course we're behind you 100%, Elkridge, and we're gonna you know, do what we can to help stop this. But what really kind of came across is, if CSX wants to put the intermodal terminal there, they're probably going to put the intermodal terminal there. You know, I mean, it's one of the few places of, you know, here's the real problem with this. You know, the CSX needs to find 70 to 100 acres of undeveloped land along the railroad tracks in the Baltimore-Washington corridor.
That's
a tough job. There's just not a lot left. And none of the remaining options are really perfect.
You know what's interesting about this? We were talking over lunch. This is like a politician's dream come true issue.
Yeah.
Because they can take whatever position they want that's politically advantageous to them. Because they don't really have a say in the outcome.
They don't have a say in the outcome. I mean, they can make noise, yes, but at the end of the day, what became very clear that is the CSX. If CSX wants it, they're going to get it. I mean, first of all, the zoning allows it.
It'd be very tough to fight that off.
Yeah, the land is zoned properly for this. They don't have to go back to the county for a special permission. And you know, I can understand the angst of some people who, you know, who live close to it. But again, they bought homes near an M2 zone.
And this whole phenomenon, the NIMBYs, the not in my backyard concept, you know, it's one that I can appreciate because I think as a homeowner, when you buy into a community, you don't want certain things in your backyard. But you're going to run the risk of that happening, particularly when you bought in and something pre-existed the construction of your home. It's going to happen.
And as it turns out, it's not a problem isolated to just Elkridge and Hanover.
Well, in fact, we've got one going on in River Hill right now, the River Hill Garden Center, which has visited by many of us for various things, either holiday decorations or the 10-week period during the spring when they make the majority of their money with shrubs and mulch and flowers and all that good stuff.
And, you know, Paul, you know I'm an old guy and I've been around here a long time. I remember.
You look good for your age,
though. I'm holding up well. I remember when Steve Klein opened that. And when he built that garden center, a couple of things that come to mind. River Hill didn't really, there were no homes anywhere near him. He was isolated by himself along there on 108. He built a garden center. He wanted to build a different garden center than anybody else had in Maryland. He took some models from California. I mean, he really went to great lengths to build a different kind of a garden center, something that would really blend in better to the community than most. Not that a garden center is really a bad thing to have in a community. But now he wants to... Actually, his issue is he wants to fix the zoning.
Well, and it's a little bit of a technical issue, but I guess the garden center in its current use is a non-conforming use. The county back in, I think, early 2000s or something like that, they changed the name of special exceptions to conditional uses,
right,
which within a particular zone allows certain types of businesses to operate.
Right.
And garden centers were actually not identified on that list at that time.
After
it was already in existence. And it wasn't on anyone's radar. And had it been on someone's radar, it probably would have made the list.
Right.
But it didn't make the list, and for now, for that reason, he's now for the last 10 years been really operating his business as a non-conforming use.
Right.
And he's trying to expand, and he's getting a lot of pushback, and they're now claiming that the conditional use isn't permitted.
Well, apparently, you know, a lot of pushback. There was a hearing, and he had more supporters than detractors at the hearing. The people that were most opposed to it, I believe, are the people whose property back up right next to it, and again, they bought a house
with a garden center
in their backyard.
And you know, it's funny. It's all the typical things that people complain of. My favorite one is, you know, increased noise. You made the crack over lunch, and I'll let you go ahead and take the credit for it.
I was talking about,
you know, you have more flowers and you have more bees, and all of a sudden bees are going to make more noise, and then you jump in with
a Venus flytrap making noise like a container.
You know, it's clapping shut, you know.
Yeah.
Come on, I even tried to give you credit for that.
I forgot.
Seize the moment.
Yes, I didn't seize the moment. My fault. Speaking of seizing the moment, the county executive put his
another fine transition.
Put his budget out there, and it's a good budget in a lot of ways. I mean, county, which I love. Council President Calvin Ball had probably the best quote in the paper. You know, his reaction to the budget. Because the budget doesn't have any furloughs for county workers, and Councilman Ball said, you know, this is great news. He really empathized with the county employees. He says we've asked a great deal of them during these difficult fiscal times. You know, leave it to Calvin to, you know, not take issue with anything that about, you know, something not getting funded or anything, but thinking of the people first.
He does do that.
He's a gem. He's really a neat guy.
Consummate gentleman.
But the budget has some candy in it for people. Ken's feeling, you know, we're in a recovery. The revenues are projected to be up.
We have a new hotel tax to help fund some stuff.
We got a new hotel tax. But here's the thing. Now, that hotel tax was supposed to benefit economic development and tourism.
Correct.
And in fact,
like two-thirds of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And in fact, the increase in the economic development budget is largely attributed to that. But in addition to that extra money that the Economic Development Office is getting from that, Ken's throwing another $150 million over. Is that right? Yeah.
$150,000.
It was $150,000.
Look, you know, if we're going to throw money somewhere, I would support throwing it at economic development. I think the economic engine is what's going to drive our recovery, and it's what's going to get this county back on its feet. With that said, I think we need to be mindful of where we're throwing dollars during a time where, you know what, we're in an economic recovery, but we ain't there yet.
Right. I wonder how Dick Story feels if the new person gets a big budget. all of a sudden, the budget gets more funding than it's ever gotten before.
And then there's that.
And then there's that. Now that Dick is gone. Now that they're without Dick. The other thing that I liked is the county is creating a new position.
It's another czar.
Another czar. A stormwater czar. This like sounds like Zeus from Mount Olympus. I am the stormwater czar.
I wonder if the stormwater czar got a housing allowance where he'd live.
I got some ideas for him. Anyway,
you know what's interesting to me about this whole budget process is, and it's no secret, you know, Ken's got greater political aspirations than Howard County, and he's rumored to probably be running for county executive. And it's interesting to me...
Governor, excuse me.
Right? And it's interesting to me that you pointed out that there's lots of candy to go around. You know, how much candy can we really afford that is really intended to help Ken and Ken's political future versus what's really right given the economic times that we're in today? And just, I throw it out there. Just throw it out there.
You know, I think you really have to look at any decisions made between now and that next election by the county executive are calculated for how it will play to a statewide audience. I just think you have to accept that.
Well, and I think that topic alone is a fascinating discussion. Maybe we have that on another show. But the whole dichotomy that exists between doing what's right for your constituents and doing what's right to continue your political career and get reelected in the next political election cycle.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big issue.
That's profound. Well, it's true, though. I mean,
Makes me want to drink.
Well, speaking of drink, it was a good legislative session for drinkers.
So, beer and wine tastings have existed for quite some time. My producer Dave over here is rolling his eyes, going, "I can't believe this."
Our transition. We could write a book about transition.
Master of the segues.
Yes.
So, wine and beer sampling is something that's been out there for quite some time. A lot of liquor stores offer samplings on, you know, Saturday afternoons or whatever.
Right.
The legislature has now passed a new bill that will allow liquor samples. So it's now been expanded from wine and beer to hard liquor.
I love it.
So vodka, rum, tequila, whiskey, scotch.
You know, are we the first county in Maryland to allow liquor tastings?
I don't know.
I don't recall ever hearing of them before.
What struck me about
Rick,
this...
Rich, you're a drinker. You ever been to a liquor tasting?
Who said I'm a drinker?
You just look like one.
Did the firefighter give me away?
Exactly.
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a big hard alcohol guy, though.
Beer guy.
I'm a beer guy.
All right. What struck me about this was that the law specifically provides that a single person may not receive more than a total of 1 ounce of liquor, 1/4 of an ounce per brand sampled in a single day.
In a single day. Yeah. So, as I said, I'm in Ellicott City in the afternoon, and I walk into my liquor store, and they're doing samples. And I have my allocated 1 ounce.
Of whiskey.
Of whiskey or whatever, or 4 different samples, because you can't have more than 1/4 ounce of anything. And then later on in the day, I'm in Maple Lawn, and they have a liquor tasting going on. Do I self-police?
Is it incumbent on you to not violate the law?
If the liquor store serves me, are they in violation of their license?
Wow.
So will they now be... Have you been to their liquor tasting?
Could you sign here to attest to the fact that you have not had another sampling in the last 24 hours?
Well, 24 hours, when did that start?
So it's like a tasting crawl.
Yeah. Yeah. It's potential. It has potential. Again, it's legislating behavior, which I never think quite works. And we have another case of that, too, where the county wants to... Well, we've talked about this before. Ken wants to bring speed cameras into the county. You know, ostensibly to slow cars down by school zones.
Did you say ostensibly?
Ostensibly.
Oh, okay.
I
thought that's what you said.
Absence,
I was like, huh?
Absence is better for the liquor tasting. We won't go there. No, ostensibly. I'm sorry. I may have slipped, but I'm talking too fast sometimes. And there are opponents to this who say it's just another way for the county to generate revenue. Okay. You know?
Look, we all speed. We all ought to slow down, particularly in school zones.
Yes.
But let's not pretend that that's what this is about.
Well, I see where you're falling on this. I hear you.
It's been shown in numerous other jurisdictions to not be effective. It's the penalty is of an amount that no one's going to challenge because it's not worth the time.
Yeah, 40 bucks.
40 bucks. Uh-huh. It's that amount where it's not really worth fighting it and going to court and taking the morning off. You know what? It's a money grab.
But so what if it is? But so what? If the county generates some more revenue from it? And because of the fact that remains is the speed limit is the speed limit, and we should adhere to the speed limits. If you don't, it's 40 bucks.
If we're really concerned about speeders in school zones, then let's make it a real deterrent.
Oh,
let's make it a point on your license. Let's make it a $250 fine.
Okay, good
if it's going to be a deterrent, then let's make it a deterrent. And look, I don't want to be dismissive of 40 bucks. 40 bucks is 40 bucks.
Absolutely.
And it means different things to different people, but it's not that much money here in Howard County for most people that is really going to have an impact.
In one of the richest counties in the country.
Right, exactly.
Forbes came out this week and said we're one of the richest.
I can't keep track of all the magazines.
All the accolades.
God, we get written up all the time.
All good. It's all good. Okay,
anyway,
speed
cameras.
What else do we have here after speed cameras we were going to talk?
Oh, have you any teeth pulled lately?
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is sad.
It's horrible.
Sad.
17-year-old
woman.
Young lady goes to get her wisdom teeth pulled.
Lives out in Woodstock, goes to get her wisdom teeth pulled, and she dies. She died. It's a couple days later.
Cardiac arrest.
Cardiac arrest. She went into a cardiac arrest after the anesthesia, I guess, and she died. And, you know, it's very sad. She was... buried this week, an aspiring young lady, and a beautiful picture of her in the flyer. But I did a little research on this.
You would?
Because I was just curious. You know, I don't know about you, but I've never heard of anybody dying from having their wisdom teeth extracted. Have you?
No, but there is that little small print piece of paper that the surgeon or the anesthesiologist gives you right before you're going under and says, can you read this? And, you know, right in there it says, risk of death.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, and you like, we just sign it. Yeah, whatever, you know, because nobody ever dies from having a tooth pulled. Well, yes, they do. I found a website. It had a strange name. I think it was called teeth.com or something like that. Here it is, teethremoval.com. And according to teethremoval.com...
I'm sorry.
They documented 51 cases of people dying from having teeth extracted. And they estimate that one out of 450,000 people runs the risk of death from tooth extraction.
Wow, that's...
Just another reason to fear the dentist.
As if we needed another one.
Yeah, exactly. As if we needed another one. Oh, my God. So, you know, yeah, I just thought...
So the chance of dying, getting your tooth pulled, your poof tooled, is greater than winning Powerball.
Yeah, it's wow. Hadn't thought about it that way. Wow. Another set, you know, on the subject of death, you have another death story.
Well, there's this homeless man who was accused of setting his girlfriend on fire, and I thought this would be a good segue for the last story since we're introducing
a firefighter
as our guest today. And, you know, it's a horrible story, and it just kind of a couple things struck me as funny about it. First of all, when the guy was interviewed, he said, well, no, actually, it was an accident. My girlfriend and I, we were having a barbecue, and we both got barbecued. So,
well,
you know,
it's not funny.
I'm trying to picture the difference between two people barbecuing burgers and getting burned,
and one person.
Versus one person trying to light another person on fire. There's such a disparity in that story. I don't get it.
I don't get it.
I can't get it. But anyway, the other point that I thought was funny about this, the guy is claiming now in his trial that he wasn't read his Miranda rights. So let's assume that he did try to set this woman on fire. So he tries to set a woman on fire, but says, but it's okay. I wasn't read my Miranda rights. I should be able to get off. Right. Look, I'm an attorney. I appreciate the importance of having your Miranda rights read to you. But at the same time, come on. You're going to light somebody on fire and then say, my Miranda rights weren't read to me?
Well, you know, and all I'm thinking about is, here's another case of people getting caught on fire in Harry County. I mean, what's his number three?
Yeah, the guy. Last couple weeks.
Last couple weeks. It's which I don't know. I guess our firefighters respond to all those.
We do respond to them. What the causes are and why they're happening, that's beyond me.
Now, do you handle a house fire differently than you handle a person fire?
Well, let's formally introduce our guest.
Let's do that.
You go ahead, Paul. Since you're the high school buddy of our guest.
Well, I'll refrain from introducing him as Richie.
That Richie's fine.
And this is Richard Rule.
Mount Hebron
goes
Vikings,
by
right?
Rich. A fellow Mount Hebron Viking graduate, president of the Howard County Professional Firefighters Association, a firefighter himself.
Yes.
And I guess the Howard County Professional Firefighters Association is the 2000th local of the International Association of Firefighters.
That's correct.
Did I get all that right?
You've done your research.
I tried.
He's good. He's
a
lawyer.
In fact, I got a whole package of research here. This is a nice
he's got my profile page and everything.
And I got all your posse here that serve on the board.
Is it a requirement for these guys to all have thick necks? I mean,
Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to make mine a little thinner, and it just kind of got away from me.
How's that working out for you?
Right. Worked that well for a while, but buying a home was very stressful.
We were just talking before the show that Rich has bought a home in my neighborhood. So I'll be.
I'm sorry for one of you all. Which one? So welcome.
Thank you.
So let's do a little background here. So you got started originally as a firefighter?
I got started originally as a volunteer, and the year escapes me. I think it was 1993, if memory serves me. With Ellicott City, went through the Volunteer Firefighter 1 class, and was kind of told by one of the instructors, hey, you've got some ability. You've got some ability to do this. You pick it up quickly. I was always mechanically minded anyway. He said, why don't you come down and ride with, you know, some of the guys that ride full-time, the career staff. You get some more experience. You'll be around the battalion chiefs. You'll get noticed. And hopefully, if you're interested in it, you might even try making a career out of it. Now, I was in a job I didn't like at the time, so I was looking for a change.
That sounded
anyway.
Pretty appealing.
Right. Right. And it was interesting to me. It was different to being behind a desk. I wasn't really into that whole mess. So I took a leap of faith, and I got hired. I got all the classes I needed, got hired as a contingent employee in 1995, and got hired full-time in May of 1997, May 12th, actually. And there's three significant dates, a little personal thing here, but three significant dates that happened on May 12th. May 12th, 1990, I graduated from college. May 12th, 1997, I started the fire academy and met my eventual wife. And May 12th of...
Was she a firefighter, too?
In the academy, yeah. She was starting out as a firefighter. And May 12th, 2008, my second son was born.
Wow. Big day for you.
Yeah.
It's coming
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. Coming up.
Coming up.
Now,
three
years old. Are you going to be looking for cards from us or?
Money.
Not necessary.
Gifts.
Okay, so we're good.
No, okay.
Right. So real quick, the difference between volunteer firefighters and career firefighters.
Okay.
As a volunteer firefighter, you've got a day job.
By and large.
And you get a call saying, hey, there's a fire at Dennis's house. Can you make it? Or how does that work?
Most of them have either digital pagers or what they call Minotaur pagers, which is actually a little audible pager that would go off with a tone that will say what the call is for their particular station. A lot of times they're either too far away at their jobs or at their jobs even close and just can't leave work to go do it. On occasion, you'll find some of the younger folks, high schoolers and college age folks who are volunteers that are around the station a lot during the summer who might be in the station during the daytime even.
And when a call comes in, the call is made to the career firefighters and they're looking for
call
assistance?
Call is made to the station. Call is made to the station that is first due or and all the other stations that are assigned to that particular emergency. Doesn't matter whether it's career station, volunteer station, combined station. The station is what the station is.
Got it.
So if somebody's available as a volunteer there, they can certainly run the call. In 10 of the 11 stations in the county, there are full-time career staff. So even if it is a volunteer station, there's still career staff, at least five of them on duty at all times.
So we have one station that has no...
Lisbon still is doing a fairly good job of getting out the door when called as a volunteer department. They have some contingent EMS personnel that they utilize. And when those people can't make it or they can't fill the schedule, they'll either detail or pay overtime to career staff to go up there and at least cover the medic unit. But they're doing a pretty good job still of getting out the door on a regular basis.
Some volunteers.
So, yeah, I give them all the credit in the world for being able to do that.
Interesting.
Because I guess as the county grows, those pressures become harder to...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not just the growth. It's the nature of firefighting anymore. Even up until the late 1990s, you could see the change coming. A lot of that was based on EMS. But after 9/11, that certainly changed. And the idea of... And it was probably this way, even though I wasn't around, obviously, back in the 50s, where, you know, you could take a guy out of high school who didn't have much education but was in decent shape, didn't mind working his tail off, and say, look, here's what you do. You pick this up, you go in there, you do this, you do that, and you come out, you rack the hose, and you go home. Right. Didn't take a whole lot of intelligence. Not trying to denigrate anybody who did it before, but that was the nature of the work. Now, with EMS being a significant part of what we do, and everybody who's a career employee in Howard County does both. We're trained in both firefighting and at least emergency medical technician, and 100 or so of us have taken on to the paramedic level, which is another 1,200 hours of schooling plus hospital work and things
right,
of that nature.
Right, to become paramedic.
Right. It's become much more specialized in that way.
So an EMS is different than a paramedic. There are two...
No, EMS is
a paramedic.
EMS is the overall emergency medical services that are provided, whether it's as an EMT or an EMT paramedic.
Okay.
It's all under the same umbrella. But in Howard County and many of the other jurisdictions around us, everybody does both. All the career employees are cross-trained for both fire and EMS.
Really?
Yeah.
Is
there
that
why
a fire agent always follows an ambulance?
Fire agent doesn't always follow an ambulance. It depends on the call. How significant the call is, and that's based on the emergency medical dispatch that they have that they follow.
It always seems like such overkill.
Well, a lot of times it's necessary. Sometimes it's not, but you can't always tell that from a phone conversation, and that's the dispatchers do their best to figure that out. But sometimes it's due to the fact that there's another call already going on in that first due area. So in my case, I'm still assigned to Station 11 at Skaggsville, Maple Lawn, whatever you want to call it. Skaggsville.
Well, the Skaggs family thinks that's important.
Right. Yeah, I used to work for part of the Skaggs family, actually. But in my station, Station 11, if there's already a call where the ambulance is out taking care of a patient and a second one comes in for that first due area, the next available piece is the engine. And because we're all cross-trained, we can at least start patient care.
Right.
Even if it's to the basic level, we can begin giving the patient oxygen if they're having chest pain, you know, helping them with their own medication if they have it that's within the protocols of the state of Maryland for emergency medical technicians. A lot of things we can do leading up to
call
a paramedic
a
arriving. Well, sometimes, unfortunately, yes. But there's a lot of things we can do to start. And then extra bodies is always a great thing. Sure. For a heavy patient, a patient always seems to be upstairs when they're really sick.
So, Rich, well, I'd love to sit here and talk war stories all afternoon. We actually had you on because of your role as the president of the Firefighters Association.
There's been a lot of... the union label.
Dave, is the show over yet? So there's been a lot in the press the last 6 months, actually probably just this year, predominantly starting in Wisconsin with the unions and whether state and county and federal employees should be parts of unions and collective bargaining, et cetera. So I want to transition a little bit into that, but tell us first, what role do you play here in Howard County as the president of the Firefighters Association?
Well, I represent, I think it's 355 now after we had a class of 25 graduate last month, firefighters and paramedics. We cover the rank from firefighter trainee all the way through lieutenant. So captains and above are not, unfortunately, part of our bargaining unit. We have 330 of them, I think, that are in the bargaining unit, and 20, a couple extra, continue to pay dues because they believe in the union and believe in what we're doing and just want to feel a part of it.
So when a lieutenant becomes a captain, he can still continue to pay dues?
He can be a member of the organization, just can't be a part of the bargaining unit.
Right.
So I represent those 355 or so people, whether it's politically... at negotiations, although I've kind of stepped away from that a little bit recently to give some other guys a chance to get involved in it. But basically run the organization day to day.
And what does the organization do?
It's the organization that represents those firefighters in their employment relationship with the county. That's the easiest and most simple way to describe it.
You handle grievances then?
Grievances, disciplinary matters, negotiations, obviously. Handle political involvement to try to get our name out there in the respect of gaining favor.
So what are the typical union issues you'll deal with on a daily basis?
Mostly relating to the provisions of the contract and how they're handled, whether they're done fair and even-handedly. Grievances on occasion, although we have...
Is there constant tension with that, with how contracts are...
No, we've been...
Or is there a good labor relationship?
There's a good labor relationship in Howard County, at least from my perspective.
Has there always been with the firefighters union?
No, certainly not. Back in the early 90s, it was pretty contentious.
Who was county exec? Was that Chuck Ecker?
Chuck Ecker. Uh-huh. Jim Roby, we improved a lot on a lot of our provisions with, including
the training
center
is named after him.
The training center began under his tenure. And thankfully, County Executive Ullman continued with that and got that project done.
So you have a little more difficulty with the Republicans than you do with the Democrats.
Overall, yes, I would say that's probably true. I haven't found that to be particularly true. I mean, there's only Republican I really deal with locally is Greg Fox, and Greg.
You have a good relationship with Greg?
I can talk to Greg. I don't know that we're always going to...
And then there's that.
I don't know that we're always going to agree on matters. And, in fact, I think we're probably on different worlds with some of the stuff that we would probably talk about. But Greg and I have always been able to talk about things and at least come to a agree-to-disagree conversation. It's always been cordial with him, for sure.
So, Rich, I'm just going to throw it out there.
Sure.
I tend to be right of center. I'm not a big fan of unions, probably because I'm ignorant and don't really understand the role that they play. And don't really understand why they need to exist and why their members should have advantages over private sector employees. I believe the 2010 United States Labor and Statistics that came out showed that workers that work for unions make roughly $10,000 more per year than their equivalent non-union workers. Mm-hmm. Now, from your perspective, you probably see that as a benefit. We're doing a good thing. We're helping increase wages.
Right.
As a private sector owner and as a business owner,
a taxpayer,
mm-hmm. who feels beat up more and more every year because I feel like there's more of a grab out there for my dollars, and revenue continues to grow, but profits are flat. This is one of those things that sort of is out there that's kind of a thorn in the side mm-hmm. of private sector business owners. Tell me, why do we need unions, especially when it comes to local, state, and federal employees?
Well, I can only speak from the firefighting aspect, the side of this. As you probably are aware, there's largely no private sector equivalent to what we do.
With the firefighters?
Yeah, there's a couple of companies out there that do some private sector contracting, fire and EMS. I think probably mostly EMS, but there are a couple fire-related companies, but there's really no private sector competitor or equivalent to it. So at least with respect to us, I look at things on a very straight unidirectional path. It is what it is. It's part of the basic functions of government is to protect its citizens, and we're a part of that. So I don't know that I can really say that I can argue for us being more paid or better paid than a private sector counterpart, because we have no comparison,
right,
in my estimation. I know you're right, based on the statistics I've heard and seen myself, that by and large, union employees are paid a higher salary and benefits than non-union employees. Don't forget, though, that over the course of the last 15, 20 years, the number of union employees has declined about 40% at least, or somewhere in that area.
But that decrease, as I understand it, has largely been in the private sector and not in government.
It absolutely has.
The public sector's actually increased.
I'm sure it has, at least from the firefighter aspect. In most cases, you'll see more firefighters on the street now than there had been in the past. Now, I can boil down the answer to the question, why should we have a local or a state union, from my perspective, down to basically one paragraph. One, we have a right to, so we've exercised that right.
Right.
Two, we have lives like everybody else does, and we want to have fun and enjoy those lives with our families, our kids, our grandparents, and whomever else. And the idea that for nothing more in some cases than political expediency, elected officials could just say, well, I don't like the schedule that the firefighters are working now, and I'm just going to change it and make it drastically different than what it is today, is unsettling to me. It's unsettling to the people that I represent. And I think that we, of all people, try to be reasonable when it comes to the expectations at bargaining, both from what the county wants from us at times where there needs to be some concessions made, but also what we expect to get when times are good. I just don't want to have anybody overnight change the way I live my life. And aside from some private sector jobs where you're at the mercy of your employer and you do what they ask them to do, we have a contract. We're happy with the contract. Otherwise, both parties wouldn't sign it.
Let me ask you something. If I'm a professional firefighter,
sure,
and I get a job in Howard County, am I required to join the union?
You're not required to join a union. Maryland does not require anybody to join a union.
And so I don't have to pay those dues if I...
You don't have to pay the dues. Now, what we can do is, and there's nobody, for the record, there's nobody in Howard County who is a person in our bargaining unit who does not pay dues. We're 100%.
Is that because they're scared not to?
I don't think so.
Is there political pressure?
Could I identify
peer
them?
Pressure?
No. I think there's probably peer pressure in a sense that it's just part of the nature of introducing yourself and saying, we are from the union, this is what we do.
You're going to benefit from what we do, so you
absolutely
should be a member.
Absolutely. I think if there's any peer pressure, I'm sure it comes from that, but that's not intentional. It's just probably the way that it feels.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Human nature.
What we're just talking about, I have no idea.
Well, I was
getting older.
You're getting like me. I was just asking whether they're compelled to join.
And you don't have to pay the dues. You don't have to be a member. However, we can require you to pay a service fee, and there's rules on what the service fee can be. It can be up to the amount of the dues, but no higher.
Convenient.
But it's only, you can only require somebody to pay a service fee for certain aspects of what the organization does, filing and adjudication of grievances,
right,
collective bargaining, because they all get, member or not,
they get the advantages
of what takes place.
So I think my employees want to live a comfortable life and spend time with their kids and grandparents, probably just like union members, whether public or private sector. Mm-hmm. Why are my employees in a different position than union members when it comes to getting what they want?
Again, I'll only go to the perspective I'm comfortable with and can speak on, and that is firefighting and firefighters. We are a hazardous job. We're hazardous employees.
You put your lives on the line.
We risk our lives every day we go out. And it could be as simple, and there's a whole lot of statistics that say that responding on the apparatus is just as dangerous as going into burning buildings in some cases.
Yeah, I like the analogy. Most of us run away from fires. You guys run out.
Right. So from that perspective, I certainly think that we're comfortable saying that we can be and should be treated differently than the average employee, the average public, private employee. And in some cases, I'm going to call it how I see it, a lot of cases, the other public employees. We're just different. It's as simple as that.
Different than the police?
No, police are pretty much in the same situation we are. I would go to bat for the police officers, and probably, even though I don't know much about them, probably the sheriff's office as well.
Are they unionized as well?
Yeah, they are. But that's what we feel, that due to the risk we take, we can, to a certain level, expect a little bit different treatment from our employers because of what we do in the end.
So I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position and speak for unions in general, and you've made clear that you really can't do that. And I actually respect and appreciate how what you do doesn't have private sector competition, right, and how it is unique. But from the perspective of unions in general, if you're comfortable opining on this, why is it okay for public officials, public sector union members, to be in a position to get more out of government, which means out of taxpayer dollars, than private sector employees in general? I mean, it's pretty well known right now that government officials across the board, whether they're union or not, have better benefits, make more money today than the private sector, particularly when we add in the benefits and the pensions. And pensions today in the private sector are unheard of. Pensions don't even exist today in the private sector.
Large part.
There's largely self-directed, right, retirement planning, mm-hmm, 401ks, simples, IRAs, etc. So why is it okay?
Shoebox,
right. Your case?
Yeah, my case.
Why is it okay for government public sector officials to make more money than private sector equivalents using the power of unions? And if you don't have an opinion, that's cool.
Here's what I'll say. Just because you have a union doesn't necessarily guarantee you higher wages or benefits. There has to be...
But statistics show...
Okay. And maybe that's just the ability of the union to stand as one and speak as one voice and do the things they have to do to gain a certain measure of confidence and belief in what they do and what they stand for than anything else. I don't know that it's anything more than the fact that they've taken upon themselves to join a union. They've taken upon themselves to get collective bargaining rights, which most private sector workers have the right to do, that is, choose not to, in many cases. We've always obviously chosen to do that.
Right.
And since we have it, we're going to use it to, let's call it what is, the fullest advantage that we have within the law to do those things. So whether it's being involved politically and trying to get people to educate, try to educate people on what we do, so the next time they're about to make a decision that may impact us negatively, maybe they'll think twice about it. We actually did an event called Fire Ops 101 two marches ago, where we invited the council members and the county executive and a couple of people from the press to come down and actually put gear on for a day and spend the day at the training academy and go in a burning building and put the fire out with pulling the hose behind them and everything else. Cut a dummy out of a car that was smashed up with the rescue tools.
Who participated in that?
It was Mary Kay Siggety, Jen Terraza, the county executive Allman. Todd Allen was there. Wanda Hutchinson was there. She had a blast.
Uh-huh.
She had an absolute blast doing that.
Wanda Hutchinson.
She's the deputy director of HR, I think is what her title is. And Todd's the head of HR. A porter whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head from the
Flyer or
from
the
Flyer or the
when Larry Carson.
No, it wasn't Larry Carson. And what's the reporter's name? My God, he'll hate me that I can't remember his name. From Channel 2. Did a story on it.
Yeah.
So it was a great success. And a lot of them told us after the fact that, one, they had no idea what it was that we really did. And, two, they were really going to think about that next time they were faced with making the decision, whether it had been funding decision or a benefit decision or things like that.
So that paid off.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Rich, we're getting to the end of the show. Just to kind of wrap it up, what's the outlook for unions in Howard County going forward?
I think right now we're in good shape. We have a county executive and county council that are supportive of us moving forward. What happens in 3.5 years, who knows?
Who knows?
Where the county executive goes, what the decisions are that the county council members make.
He becomes governor.
Whatever he might do. and how the county council decisions shake out and what they end up looking like. will be involved in it.
Courtney Watson becomes county executive.
Whatever happens, you know,
she's kind of Republican, though. You got to be careful.
We'll work with it. That's not a big deal at all. But we'll, rest assured, we'll be on the front lines with our gold and black signature IFF or whomever that it is that we're rooting for. So
great.
We'll be out there.
Well, Rich, I'm not going to thank you for your work as the president of the Firefighters Union, but I am going to thank you for your work as a firefighter here in Howard
County.
You're
very welcome.
Thank you for your
service.
You're
very welcome.
So, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That about wraps up yet another episode of And Then There's That. On behalf of myself and my co-host, Paul Scalney, we'd like to thank our producer, Dave Bittner, for making us look good on radio, and to General Growth Properties, the Easter Bunny, and the Mall in Columbia for hosting our show again today. We'll be back again on May 6th for a legislative wrap-up show focusing on the recently concluded Maryland General Assembly. We hope you'll join us.